The Heaven Field, a novel by I.G. Hume, read by the author. Episode 19, A Cruel Angel. Goodridge crept along the low fissure of rock on his stomach, the fellow members of his team stretching back in a long line behind him. So far the infiltration had gone surprisingly well. In the chaos of the storm, his four-man team had slipped unnoticed through the main lines of defence. Sounds of explosions, shots and screams came from the direction of the diversionary assault. Their attackers, although far better equipped, seemed poorly disciplined, and Gutteridge's team had encountered no resistance as they sneaked through a gap in the line. He had grave misgivings about their chances of flying the craft, should they even get that far, if they were unable to capture a pilot. And with the reports of the enemy disappearing and reappearing at will, the chances of prisoners seemed slim. He went rigid, motioning his team to halt as two figures loomed out of the swirling dust. Painstakingly slowly, Gutteridge raised his bulky gun, pointing it at the nearest of the two. They moved rapidly across his vision, and then they were gone, disappearing into the storm, heading for the fighting. He motioned his group to continue onwards. The rocky terrain afforded plenty of cover, and even in their cumbersome suits they managed to gain the high ground, and found themselves looking down into a small depression. Three aircraft were huddled together under heavy tarpaulins, protecting them against the howling sandstorm. A few troops moved between the craft on sentry duty, but there were weaknesses to Gutteridge's eye. More troops appeared to be billeted in a large structure, which looked like a rectangular cargo container on the perimeter of the depression. Gutteridge looked anxiously across to their pilot. It seemed quite unrealistic to hope that he would be able to figure out the controls of an unfamiliar aircraft, especially since they would probably be under fire at the time. They withdrew from the exposed ridge, finding a small gully nearby, and there Gutteridge explained their plan. Thomas stumbled down the street as fast as his exhausted legs could carry the huge extra weight of his cumbersome suit. He dragged Grace along by the hand, and she followed without resistance. She seemed to have no volition left of her own. Above the frantic shouts and screams from the rest of the team over the open channel, Thomas could hear Grace's sobbing.
"We can't leave them. We can't," she repeated.
But she let Thomas lead her up the narrow cobbled street. He recognised one voice as that of Adams, the security team leader, frantically trying to organise his men.
"Greer! Smith! Get behind them! Get behind them! No, don't!"
A harsh burst of static cut out another voice, and Thomas blinked through his tears and tried to increase his pace. The sounds of fighting were growing fainter now, as the shadowy street led out into a small, paved square. The buildings leaned in and around them, the black emptiness of the broken windows staring down ominously. Thomas gazed around him at the crazy jumble of buildings in wonder. A modern concrete tower thrust out of the ruins of a Tudor farmhouse, and opposite, the shell of a Victorian terrace merged into a huge wall of medieval stonework. In the centre of the broken paving stood a small, ruined fountain, a cracked and overgrown statue of an angel. Its arms spread in supplication stood atop it. Thomas came to a halt, breathing heavily and leaning against the side of the empty pool, its floor choked with dry weeds. Grace slumped heavily to the ground, her crying quieter now. Thomas looked warily back down the darkened alleyway. He suddenly realised that the gunfire had ceased, and there were no more voices in his earpiece. A deathly silence had been hung over them, with only the occasional low moan of the wind blowing over the rooftops. He gazed about the square, trying to get his bearings. A faint movement from the shadows of another alley caught his eye, and for a second he thought he glimpsed a tall figure, but as he looked again there was nothing there. He slumped down beside Grace, lost in silent thought. He wondered if any of the others had escaped. They would have all stayed and fought, he thought bitterly to himself.
"I think we're safe now," he whispered,
turning to Grace, who lay sprawled against the low wall of the fountain. The shot struck the angel statue, and it burst into a shower of fragments before the sound of the gun's retort had reached Thomas's ears. He was thrown to the ground by the force of the blast, as several more bursts of energy whined overhead.
"Who's doing this to us? Why are they doing this to us?"
screamed Grace, writhing on the ground with her arms over her head. Thomas lay dazed for a moment, disorientated and winded, There was a strong smell of smoke inside his helmet, and he realised that the noise behind the ear-splitting shriek of the energy blasts was that of his own suit's alarm system. He tried to roll onto his side to see where his attackers were, and a sharp pain stabbed at his back. A shower of sparks flew up from the side of his helmet, and the alarms went dead. The gunfire ceased for a second, and Thomas managed to pull himself into a sitting position, with his back against the low wall of the fountain. Grace lay prone a few feet away from him. He couldn't tell whether she were alive or dead, and the pain in his back prevented him from moving towards her. The lights around his visor flickered once, then failed, and he coughed, choking on the acrid smoke inside his helmet. He looked wildly around. He thought he could hear a faint hissing of air escaping from the canisters on his back. The square was populated by dark shadows, all of which looked menacing. He thought he saw the dark shape of the figure he had seen earlier, hidden in the alleyway, but the smoke and dust on his visor obscured his vision.
"Please, help me,"
he croaked through the pain, but it was no more than a cracked whisper. The shadow melted back into the darkness, as three dark-suited troops appeared warily from the alley Thomas had just come from. They made their way cautiously over the empty square, to where he lay slumped and gasping.
"This one's still alive," came a harsh voice from the nearest of the troops.
"Finish him off, then," said another, as he bent down and rolled Grace's body over onto her back.
Thomas's breathing was fast and shallow, but he felt strangely removed from events, as if he didn't quite believe they were happening. The pain in his back took most of his attention, and as the soldier raised his gun towards him, he felt no fear. He watched, curious and detached, as the soldier dropped his gun to the floor and threw up his hands to his throat with a bubbling gasp. The man's knees buckled, and he toppled slowly forward, crashing to the floor, sprawled on Thomas's legs. To Thomas's surprise, the body shimmered for an instant and then disappeared. The soldier kneeling beside Grace gave a short scream and then slumped over Grace's unmoving form before he too melted away. Thomas stared transfixed, smiling to himself as he slipped out of consciousness. The third trooper was firing wildly into the shadows, the bursts of his gunfire exploding all around. He screamed in terror at something out of Thomas's vision. It was the most terrifying cry he had ever witnessed, a primordial expression of some deepest fear. The soldier threw his gun to the ground and made a run for it, back towards the alley. He managed three strides before his legs buckled underneath him and he fell to the floor and melted into nothingness. Thomas was intrigued by the scene, with the detached curiosity of a dying man. A movement drew his eye once more, and he saw the shadow separate itself from the darkness and move towards him. It must have been at least 8 feet tall, moving in slow, ungainly strides, which looked painful and unwilling. It was some huge suit of corroded, blasted metal, enormous and of incredible mass. The great helmet the figure wore had two small black eyepieces deeply set into it, and the whole suit seemed as if it had spent an eternity at the bottom of the sea. It carried what looked to be a weapon, still smoking and hissing, a gun built into the suit and onto its arm. A huge, cumbersome metal claw was fixed to the left hand. The ground trembled as it approached, and then it halted a few feet from where Thomas lay. He imagined he could see two pale eyes behind the dark glass of the eyepieces.
"Please, help,"
he managed at last, as he drifted towards unconsciousness. Adams pushed Nix and Starling roughly through the open doorway into a dark, ruined cellar.
"Get going," he hissed. "Try and hide somewhere. I'll haul them off. Go!"
He pushed them both into the cellar and turned back towards the street, peering cautiously up the steps from the doorway. Nix and Starling stood unmoving for a second, then Gary, forcing himself to try and think clearly, pulled Nix by the arm.
"Let's go,"
he whispered, and they made their way through the dark, damp room which was strewn with rubble. The ceiling above their heads, held up by rotting beams and pillars, was cracked, letting in dim shafts of feeble light, and they managed to stumble across to a doorway at the far end of the room. Starling peered through cautiously. It led off into the darkness down a dingy corridor. He went to move, then stopped dead as he heard Nix's sharp intake of breath. He turned around in time to see the atmosphere in the room flicker, as the shape of three figures traced themselves in the air, solidifying as he watched. The soldiers had their backs to them, facing Adams, who still peered back up the steps, unaware of their presence.
Starling watched in terror as all three slowly raised their weapons, pointing them at Adam's back.
"Get out!"
yelled Nick suddenly, and Starling watched aghast as he threw himself against the nearest pillar. The three soldiers span around, searching for them in the gloom. There was a whine of servos as Nix heaved against the column, using the power of the sample claws to push with all his might. With a deafening roar and crash of rubble, the pillar gave way, and Starling just managed to heave Nix back as the whole ceiling crashed down. Rubble and beams, bricks and dust rained down on them, and Starling rolled on the floor where he and Nix had tumbled, just avoiding a huge piece of falling masonry. The crashing died away to a deadly silence, and Starling sat up, pushing lumps of wood and rubble off his legs. He looked around anxiously in the dust.
"Nix,"
he hissed.
"Nix, are you all right?"
He heard a low moan, then a huge beam moved slowly upwards to reveal Nix covered in mortar dust. There was a scrambling from the other side of the room, then the sudden crack of a weapon as two shots rang out. Adams, dusty and battered, stumbled over the rubble, his gun expelling a fine trace of smoke from the muzzle.
"Everyone okay?"
he grunted, helping Nix to his feet. They both nodded shakily.
"Come on then, let's get out of here."
He led them off towards the dark corridor ahead of them. He turned to Nix as they went through the door.
"Good work, by the way," he muttered, and then plunged into the darkness.
Laszlo Sradic gazed out through the small windows of their quarters alongside the airfield. He cursed quietly to himself. The storm showed no signs of abating, and reports over the comlinks weren't good. The Americans, it seemed, had launched a concerted effort to break out and had punched a hole through their front line. They had been held eventually, after an hour or so of heavy fighting, and now Laszlo's companions were regrouping, awaiting orders to infiltrate behind their lines and cut them off. The enemy wouldn't succeed this time, but casualties had been sustained by the sounds of it, and that was not good. They couldn't afford to lose men. They were already hopelessly outnumbered as it was. If the storm would just clear, they could get their ships in the air, and then they would teach them. He might actually be of some use, Laszlo thought bitterly to himself. As it was, he felt impotent and more than a little frightened, listening to the frantic sounds of shots and cries over the radio.
"Laszlo!"
It was the harsh, guttural voice of his sergeant.
"Sir!"
he called, running over to where the terrifying security officer stood brooding at an opposite window.
"Looks like your tarpaulins are coming loose in the storm," grunted the man. "Take someone and get them fastened. We don't want sand filling up the intakes. Those ships need to be ready as soon as this shit clears. Now get going and do the job properly this time."
The big man spat the words at him, and Laszlo saluted wearily and headed for the airlock, glad to be away from his vulgar superior for a while. He staggered out of the airlock a few minutes later, almost bent double against the wind. His ship was the farthest from their quarters, last in a line of three squat fighter aircraft, and he cursed as he battled his way across the lifeless red rock.
"Hey, Dimitri!"
he shouted to one of the sentries.
"Give me a hand lashing the covers down, will you? This storm's going to tear the whole camp apart."
The soldier grumbled and followed Laszlo over to the ship. After much cursing and struggling, they managed to catch the flailing cover as it whipped about in the wind.
"Shit, that's funny,"
murmured Laszlo.
"Looks like the cable snapped. Or been cut."
He looked up as a dark figure seemed to rise up from the shadows in front of him.
"Put your hands behind your head,"
screamed the figure, pointing a gun straight at Laszlo's chest. Instinctively, he went to push the emergency release on his suit, but he wasn't quick enough. The figure punched him in the stomach with the muzzle of his gun, and Laszlo crumpled to the floor, gasping for breath.
"Hands on your fucking head,"
screamed the soldier again, and this time Laszlo complied instantly. He looked up as a shot rang out. Dimitri had been faster than he, and had got to his release button, slipping out of the field. But he wasn't quick enough. The blast tore through him as he was just starting to fade, and he gave a brief scream and fell to the floor. His body seemed to hover on the edge of solidity for a second, then disappeared, his dead eyes staring in blank terror through his visor. Chaos erupted around the airfield. Shots burst all about them as the sentries realized they were under attack.
"Get up!"
screamed the soldier, grabbing him roughly and pulling him to his feet.
"Open up the ship, now!"
he yelled, and without knowing what he was doing, Laszlo opened up the main hatch and stumbled up the loading ramp, followed closely by the soldier and two of his companions. Explosions flared up outside the ship in a deafening madness as Laszlo was pushed up the narrow walkway into the cramped cockpit.
"Okay,
shouted the soldier over the din, holding Laszlo by the scruff of the neck. You're going to prep the ship and fly it out of here now.
But...
he managed before he was roughly punched in the stomach again. He opened his eyes only to see the muzzle of the man's gun pressed against his visor.
Now!
Laszlo frantically complied, prepping the systems and running pre-flight diagnostics as the ship rocked in the storm, or shuddered as it was struck by small arms fire. The whine of the engines began to rise above the howl of the wind, and the cockpit lights blinked into life.
Okay, people, fall back to the ship, called the soldier into his comlink. Fall back! Myers, get the rest of the covers off the ship.
The shooting intensified, and Laszlo worked frantically under the soldier's terrifying gaze.
Fuck me about and you'll be dead before you know it, he muttered, looking out of the cockpit as more enemy troops came over the crest of the ridge and opened up on the ship.
After what seemed like a lifetime of frenetic activity, Laszlo sighed and turned to the soldier.
There, it's done, he babbled. But you'll never take off in this storm.
You're the one doing the flying, so I guess your life's in your own hands, yelled the man, pushing Laszlo roughly towards the pilot's chair.
No, I can't, screamed Laszlo. I can't do it.
You're the fucking pilot, you're going to have to. I'll open up that visor of yours and we'll see how long you can hold your breath.
But I'm not a pilot, he yelled hysterically.
What?
I'm just a mechanic, Laszlo whimpered. Please, I can't do it.
The soldier stopped and stared as if he had been struck. The ship rocked again as more explosions burst around it.
You know the systems, right? You work on these ships, you're not some goddamn janitor or something.
Laszlo nodded madly, then shook his head.
No, I know the ships. I work on them, he sobbed.
Right then. Let's hope you're a good teacher, too.
Myers,
how long till the entry point opens up again?
7 minutes.
Right. Get Partridge in here.
A few seconds later, another soldier burst into the cockpit. The first soldier turned back to Laszlo.
Sit next to him. He's a pilot. Tell him what does what.
Partridge, if you can crash us in the entry point, then we might just make it home alive.
Take her up,
he shouted, strapping himself into the nearest seat. The mountainous figure regarded Thomas from where it stood and moving a few feet away. The pain in Thomas's back wouldn't allow him to move, so he sat there gasping in the creature's shadow. After what seemed like an age, Thomas heard movement to his left, and then Grace crawled into his field of view. She scrambled unsteadily towards him, looking up in horror at the monstrous giant above her, which seemed to regard the two intently with its shadowed eyes. Thomas could see Grace's mouth moving as she spoke frantically to him, but his earpiece was dead, and he couldn't make out her words. Blood trickled down her chin from a cut on her lip, and tears rolled down her cheeks. He attempted to speak, but the pain cut through him once again, and he broke into a racking cough, spattering blood inside his helmet.
What is it?
He heard a shout next to his ear, gesturing up at the figure, but he couldn't reply. She looked at him in concern, then started going over his suit, checking it. She eased him gently onto his side, and he cried out in agony, which degenerated once more into a coughing and sputtering.
There's a piece of metal. Oh, God, it's in your back,
she shouted at last.
It's gone to your suit, but it's melted the padding and sealed it again. Just don't move.
Thomas was horrified. He had read a detailed report of what had happened to Patty when she was exposed to the atmosphere.
Is the emergency decompression system damaged?
He managed to croak at last.
What? Oh, Thomas, I'm sorry,
stuttered Grace, her face close to his. A thin red dust whipped around the square in small eddies and zephyrs.
We just haven't had the resources to put the system in the newer suits. There's been so many to produce. We simply didn't have the manpower.
Her voice tailed off to a whisper, as the tears ran down her cheeks.
Don't let me die like that,
he moaned in a hoarse croak. His eyes were starting to look glazed.
Not like that, please.
Grace had turned to the immovable figure, and was sobbing at its feet, gesturing and pleading with it to help, but the creature didn't show any sign of life. There was a cold, burning sensation, as the fabric of Thomas's suit finally gave way.
No, Grace, please!
He screamed as he felt things writhing and wriggling inside his suit, making their way up his back and around his neck. He was thrashing about in fear and pain as Grace attempted to hold him down. He saw many dark shapes inside his helmet, scuttling things that forced their way into his mouth as he cried out. Behind Grace there was a screech of rusty metal as the huge figure straightened up to its full height. The great, ugly muzzle of its weapon lifted up to point straight towards him.
"Susan,"
Thomas mumbled, almost inaudibly, as he choked on writhing, wriggling things. There was a flash as the creature discharged its gun, straight into Thomas's dying body. Alex looked up as the door swung open, grinding on its rusty hinges. He bit his lip as he waited for more visions to assail him, but it was only the guard and the familiar figure of Dr. Henschel, who shuffled into the cell as the guard closed the door. Alex pressed himself back against the far wall as the old man approached. Henschel looked gaunt and dishevelled, his hair unkempt and his eyes bloodshot and feverish. There was a strange pallor to his skin. Alex noticed that he wore his old lab coat once again.
"Alexei,"
hissed the old man under his breath, looking back over his shoulder as if he feared he were being watched.
"Oh, Alexei, what a fool I've been."
He advanced upon Alex, his arms outstretched, and Alex flinched, but he had nowhere left to retreat. The old man slumped onto the bed beside him, clasping Alex's hand.
"What is it?"
stuttered Alex, terrified that Henschel would transform once again into that horrendous monster.
"It was me all along,"
he sobbed.
"They were using me, Alexei. I realize that now."
He was feverish and raving.
"I can't hold them off much longer,"
he hissed, his lips close to Alex's ear.
"I've almost run out of time."
He sighed and pulled out a bottle of tablets from his coat pocket. He poured out a handful of pills and forced them manically into his mouth. Alex thought they looked like amphetamines.
"We haven't long,"
he mumbled, chewing the tablets.
"I have done it. I've put an end to it as best I could. You must escape, Alexei. I realize it is you. You are the link. You must escape, my friend. I've prepared a ship for you in Hangar 13. Go, Alexei. Escape. Prevent a war. It was war they wanted all along."
Alex stared in horror at the raving man, whose face was only inches from his own.
"You must do it, Alexei,"
he whispered, and stood up suddenly. He swayed a little, then walked woodenly to the door, as if he had to force his limbs to comply with his will. He knocked heavily on the metal, and the cell door swung inwards, leaving Alex dumbstruck where he sat. As the door closed, there was a muffled grunt, and Henschel appeared again, a long kitchen knife clenched in his fist. Blood dripped down his fingers, and there was a vivid smear of red down his white coat. Alex stood up in alarm and followed him out of the room. The body of the guard lay at Henschel's feet, a livid wound across the dead man's throat. Alex stared in incomprehension at Henschel.
"What have you done?"
he gasped.
"Go,"
whispered the old man, suddenly calm and lucid.
"I have destroyed our array. Nobody else will enter the field. Take the aircraft in Hangar 13. Get help, Alexei. Warn the world about the impending attack. I fear it is too late to prevent it." "What about you? Can't you come with me?"
whispered Alex, as he knelt down and took the guard's pistol. Henschel sighed and shook his head. He swayed a little as he spoke.
"Soon the fortress will be breached. I cannot hold her off for much longer," he said. "Go quickly."
"Her?" asked Alex, looking up in alarm.
"It's the woman, isn't it? The one who has spoken to me. Who is she?" "There is no time," sobbed the old man. "And I would have no answers that would satisfy you. There are no words. You must leave now."
Alex nodded and gave the old man a long look of understanding. Then he was gone, running down the narrow corridors as fast and as quietly as he dared, making his way towards Hangar 13.
"Who are you?"
gasped Thomas. He was lying on a squalid iron-frame bed in the corner of a low-ceilinged room. Damp streamed down the walls and a bare bulb gave off a sickly glow.
"Where's Grace?"
he asked anxiously, trying to raise himself up on his elbow. His helmet and backpack lay on the floor next to him, and as he moved he realized the pain in his back was gone.
"Who are you?"
he asked again. The huge figure, still dressed in its enormous metal suit, sat at a small, deep-set window. Flashes of lightning outside cast disturbing shadows about the bare concrete walls. slowly, with a low screech of metal. The figure turned its head to regard Thomas. The movement seemed painful and ungainly in the rusty handicap of the corroded suit. The blank lamps of its eyes appraised Thomas for a moment, and then with a great metallic squeal the figure rose from its seat and approached the bed. Thomas shrank back against the wall, but upon searching his instincts he realised that he felt no fear.
"Where's Grace?" he stuttered. "Please, is she safe? Who are you?"
"Who am I?"
A deep voice, slow and filled with sorrow, slid from the heavy face mask.
"First, you must put on your helmet," said the figure.
Thomas nervously complied, clumsily shouldering his backpack and clicking his helmet into place. The panels on his visor sprang into life with lights and readouts. The diagnostics on his suit checked out okay. It appeared to have been repaired. Then slowly, painfully, the huge bulk of the figure raised its hand to its head, and with a hissing and clanking of bolts and locking, lifted its own helmet. It seemed to take an age for the figure to remove its suit, piece by piece, layer by layer. Thomas stared open-mouthed and awestruck. Under the scarred and battered helmet was another, into which the large black eyepieces were set. Next was revealed a face mask, and breathing apparatus made up of tubes and hoses, all old and corroded. Layer upon layer was removed with slow, weary movements, and then suddenly Thomas saw a hand, pulled from out of a gauntlet, itself from within the huge metal claw. The hand was the most delicate and elegant he had ever seen, with impossibly pale, translucent skin which seemed to glow a soft white light. Next, Thomas saw a part of a face revealed, beautiful in its perfection, and Thomas wondered why such features should ever be hidden under that ungainly armour. And then the final pieces of the suit were removed, and Thomas stared, spellbound, everything else forgotten. The figure seemed to unfold itself from the last of the metal casing. It was impossibly beautiful, with bare, slender limbs, high cheekbones and long, slanting eyes which contained no white at all. They were two black orbs which seemed to hold all the sorrow there ever was. Thomas cried as he looked upon the figure.
"You're an angel,"
he whispered through his tears.
"Words belittle the world, Thomas. But yes, we've been called such. And more."
The voice was slow and melancholic, deeply musical, and seemed to come from all around.
"Why did you bring me here?"
stuttered Thomas. He wanted to look away. The creature's beauty was too much for his eyes, but he couldn't tear his gaze away.
"You asked for my help,"
replied the angel simply. It stood motionless, regarding Thomas. It was naked and hairless, and seemed androgynous. It was over 7 feet tall at least, and its skin seemed almost transparent, revealing a fine tracing of veins over its body.
"You're so beautiful,"
stuttered Thomas.
"Why do you wear all that, those layers?"
He looked about at the pile of ugly metal surrounding the angel.
"We fight a war, Thomas. We must protect ourselves,"
whispered the angel.
"From what?"
asked Thomas, sitting up on the edge of the bed. The angel paused for a moment, then sighed.
"From you,"
it replied. The force of the sorrow in those words struck Thomas like a physical blow.
"Me? But how? I don't understand,"
he gasped.
"From you and all your kind,"
breathed the angel, with utter resignation.
"Your mind's killers. You have no control. We are without hope, and we wait now only for the end."
The angel spoke to Thomas with no malice, only melancholy.
"But I don't,"
gasped Thomas, his head reeling in confusion.
"You must go now. Your friend is waiting for you."
The angel swayed a little as it spoke.
"Follow the corridor to the outside. You will find her there."
"Grace, she's all right, but who are you? I mean, there's so many questions."
Thomas got up from the bed and started towards the door without thinking. The angel turned and walked slowly back to its chair by the window.
"You are special, Thomas,"
it whispered.
"Precious and dangerous."
Thomas gasped as he saw a huge, bloodless gash in the small of the creature's back. The angel staggered and slumped into its seat, staring out at the small window.
"You're hurt,"
said Thomas.
Let me help you. Who did this? Who do you fight?
You did this, said the angel distantly. It will pass. Do not grieve. You must go. Even with the suit you wear, your presence is painful to me. Without it, your fear would kill me.
Thomas staggered to the doorway in a daze. He stopped and turned, regarding the figure once again.
We hurt you so much, and yet you helped me. Why?
He whispered through his tears.
It has always been so. It is our existence, said the angel solemnly, still gazing out of the window. Go now, Thomas. We may meet again before the end.
Thomas turned and fled down the corridor, choking on his tears. He stopped at a large rusty metal door, sealed with a huge iron bar mechanism. He fumbled with the handle, heaving it with all his might, and with a low boom the heavy door swung outwards. He seemed to be in some rudimentary airlock, with an identical metal door a few feet from the one he had just opened. After closing the first door, he opened the second, and was out into dim corridors. He stumbled up a flight of steps towards a glimmer of light, and suddenly he was out into the familiar howl of a red dust storm. He staggered forwards, unable to see in the chaos, and after a few moments tripped on a bulky object lying on the floor. He fell on his face with a shriek, and when he looked up, the dust had cleared a little, and he was staring up at Grace, who knelt over him.
"Please help him," she cried, addressing someone unseen, and then stopped herself, staring around in disbelief. "Where did he go? Thomas? Thomas, are you all right?"
She looked concernedly into his face.
I'm okay, he said distantly, then pulled himself together. We've got to get back to the labs, he said urgently. But your suit, can you make it?
Asked Grace, looking in disbelief for the tear in his clothing.
I'm fine, I'll try and explain later. Come on.
He got to his feet and pulled Grace up beside him. They looked around, there seemed to be no landmarks in the red sandstorm.
Where are we?
Breathed Grace.
Where have the buildings gone? I don't know, but I think we should get out of here.
They headed off, staggering against the wind, not knowing in which direction they went.
You have been listening to The Heaven Field. For more information, downloads, and artwork, visit theheavenfield.com.